Good evening, and welcome to this week's Veil Mohammed Al-Wahidi, Director of the Egyptian Committee in Gaza, edition of Spin Cycle. Radiotherapy for the news obsessed. I wanted to get that in.
And I say, not as funny as your usual, no, but very but poignant.
We were talking about it before, and it's not a subject we're going to cover in the show, but it is a really poignant and just sort of a story that stops you in your tracks and makes you think about the world and the state of it. So I would encourage you to look that up. We are broadcasting from the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, lands for which sovereignty has never been ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. Thank you so much to Lauren, of course, for breaking and entering back 4 p.m. next Thursday, keeping us alive and toasty musically on our cold winter evenings. Thursday evenings. I'm Jess Lilly in the studio with Rachel Withers and Charlie Lewis for Spin Cycle this evening. How are you?
Evening. Not too bad.
I can't see you, Rachel. No. Because I've got this massive screen in front of me. I'm just going to do some rearranging.
I'm pretty good. I've got a puppy in my arms.
I know. She's so cute. That voice comes out every time I see Lumi.
Yeah, I've never heard that voice from you, to be honest.
You're lucky you're not my children. In about 15 minutes, we're going to be chatting to Andrew Dodd. He's coming into the studio, which we always appreciate. One half of the authors of an amazing book, Getting Murdoch'd, which analyzes how Murdoch's media wields power and punishment. A lot of the stories we have heard before, but the way they tie them together and the through lines that they create, it's just a brilliant book. First, in this week's news, the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion has been going for approximately 78,000 years, 700 days and 15,000 hours. But today made media news as the anti-Semitism envoy Jill Siegel took the stage and made some pretty mad suggestions for the ABC's coverage of Israel. Rachel, what's the story?
Yes. Well, we're in this block of hearings that is focused on the media and social media. And today we got the anti-Semitism envoy, Julian Siegel, basically accusing the ABC and SBS, mind you, of overemphasizing Gaza in their coverage. And she argued that an oversight committee would be needed to vet their coverage. This is not a new idea from our anti-Semitism envoy, but she used her testimony to argue basically that there was a, quote, common and pervasive perception in the Jewish community that the ABC's coverage of the war lacked balance and that it gave disproportionate voice to anti-Israel perspectives. Of course, according to her, anti-Israel perspectives are those that are critical of Israel.
Yes, and Israel's particularly actions. Its conduct of the war in Gaza. Which
I can't imagine where those. Why anyone would be criticizing.
I feel like Israel is bringing those perspectives on itself.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think a lot of people would argue the ABC has given a lot of airtime to actual Israeli government
as
members and representatives and ambassadors, and that hasn't really looked too good for Israel.
Well, not only that, you know, we've seen a lot of examples of you know, the way that headlines are written and third person reporting for, you know, Israel, whereas, you know, it's people died versus people killed and all of that sort of stuff. I would suggest that, I mean, from our point of view, and of course I am put my hand up and say I have a particular perspective. I'm not, and I don't share her perspective. So, you know, it is very easy to be, you know, to take your own corner and say, oh, that's absolutely, you know, not that's absolutely nonsense. Israel are given way more positive coverage than Gaza, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, everyone thinks that a little bit. Everyone thinks that their view is not given enough time
exactly.
in the mainstream media.
But I would, I mean, I find it really interesting that that perspective that it comes up at the Royal Commission, and also with her advice is that that stories need to be pre-vetted as well. Like, it wasn't she suggesting that today that there should be a committee of oversight that would pre-vet stories, which is not clear if it's pre or but
the exact way that works is a bit vague, which I think is kind of by design. So it's not entirely clear whether you'd have to run it by them before you publish anything on the subject.
I think the idea of vetting and the idea of an oversight committee, and it's something we'll probably get into with our guest Andrew Dodd on the Murdoch Media, is it's almost more about cowing the ABC into fear of covering Israel 100%. In a critical, and I say critical as in analytical way.
But also being afraid of, or with every single article on or piece or whatever on the subject is like, oh, what's this committee going to say about this? Mm. And self-censoring even publish.
I would argue, you know, from things I've heard from people at the ABC already does
that. A lot of that itself. On a lot of
every
subjects.
Every single story about Israel.
But also, and every subject really that could
every
possibly.
Subject, but especially on this, they have been hyper conscious. I mean, we don't need to rehash the Antoinette Latouf case, but there is like hypersensitivity in the highest levels of the ABC about how their coverage is perceived. I'd also point to an Instagram account I only came across this week called Missing Context that had a post a week ago now pointing out that just last week the ABC detailed findings of on anti-Jewish hate and omitted evidence on anti-Muslim hate. There were two reports that came out on the rise in both Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, and the ABC had a piece that only addressed one of them. And it's like Gillian Siegel wants to go to the Royal Commission and say the ABC is not covering anti-Semitism properly. I mean,
I also think it's incredibly rich to suggest the ABC needs an oversight committee on the coverage of Israel when people clearly have direct lines to them, because we saw that in emails
in the breakdown
directly to Ida Buttrose. Do you know what I mean? Like, there is already an oversight committee working in the background.
The other element to this, which I think kind of really always just clangs me in the face every time this stuff comes up, is that my kind of early journalism career perfectly coincides with the years, literal years, that Australia's government and media class from the conservative side were prioritizing above anything else they could have been talking about. They were prioritizing the restriction of 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, which they felt was too broad and too vague and was had a chilling effect on free speech and worthwhile debates, which is something that I don't always completely disagree with. But regardless, that was their focus for years. The idea that the government would set up a vetting process that a certain subject would have to be run through before it could be published is, I would argue, quite a big overreach in terms of free speech and the debate, the free exchange of ideas. I don't see any of the people who dedicated books and books and books to the Racial Discrimination Act, and particularly in the case of Bill Leake, the late cartoonist who was facing proceedings under that. I don't see any of the people who were so exercised by that issue during 2016 to about 2018 have anything to say about any of these proposals. Even on a principled, like you could say, look, I totally agree that anti-Semitism is out of control in this country. I believe that there's a horrible risk, et cetera, et cetera. I believe that Israel is unfairly criticized. You could say all those things and still say, but I'm uncomfortable with the idea of government mandated censorship of pieces that concern with the subject.
Free speech for me and not for ye is the subject of our next interview.
Well, hopefully Andrew will be able to, you know, sort this out for me, because I'm very confused.
I just want to say, though, I don't expect any kind of consistency on free speech matters from the Murdoch media. Let's not beat around the bush here. That's what we're going to talk about next. But I've also been really disappointed in the coverage of this testimony from other media outlets that are not News Corp. Just taking like a bit of a look, because I like googled this story to organize my summary at the top of this show, and we've got The Guardian. ABC and SBS need oversight committee to vet Israel coverage, Gillian Siegel tells Royal Commission. And it's entirely just like sentences from Gillian Siegel, said Siegel, and it's not really pushing back on
this
at all. The AFR, Siegel accuses ABC of overemphasizing Gaza. Execs reject bias claims. They at least got the fact the ABC rejects that in the headline.
To be honest, even the ABC actually reports pretty straight on what Sue had to say.
I know.
Which you can understand. Again, they... Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I need to tell you what the Australian's headline is, so I won't. But not good.
Very quickly, Andrew Dodd is here. We're very excited to welcome him in a moment. Before we do that, we should mention the fact that next Thursday...
We got to plug something.
Yes. Next Thursday here, Spin Cycle has taken a slightly different form. I, as the person who sits behind the desk and operates the panel and enjoys that element of control, very afraid.
I assume because we're going to be chain smoking throughout the whole event.
On stage in the performance space, but it's going to be amazing. So the subject is, or the provocation is, who killed journalism? And we are inviting three expert guests.
Three expert witnesses
to give us their theories.
To the Royal Commission into
who killed journalists.
Oh, my God. Oh, why did we call it a Royal Commission?
We've got to rename the whole thing. We've got to redo all the ads.
So, of course, Najma Sambal is an OG spin cycler, amazing journalist and broadcaster, and she'll be here with her point of view. Issa, who is the founder of Deep Cut News, wrote for The Guardian, but also really cut his teeth in the Arab Spring and in the Middle East as a journalist. And so we'll bring an amazing point of view. And Ref Epstein, who currently presents the morning show on ABC Melbourne Radio. And I think I would say, like, I know him for someone who is incredibly sort of even-handed with inviting everyone's point of view into the mix. So I'll be interested to hear.
He's also been doing journalism a really long time.
So what an amazing combination of people, and you bloody well have to come. You have to come. You should go online now. You can rrr.org.au. If you're a subscriber, you can put yourself – what's the word? Put yourself down to
in
come
the draw,
to the thing.
Or you just put your name down?
Yeah.
And you know what? If you really, really, really want to come – text us your name now to 0466981027, and three of us will just put you on our special friend
list. We're very
happy
to do that. We are very easily corrupted in this context.
We want the room filled, people. Stick around. You're tuned to Spin Cycle on Triple R. Don't go away, because we are about to have an incredible conversation about an amazing book. Andrew Dodd is one half of the authors of Getting Murdoch'd, a new book that analyses how Murdoch's media wields power and punishment. And that'll be in a moment.
Independent Melbourne Radio 3RRR.
Getting Murdoch'd is a new book that presents somewhat of a modern-day horror story, the meticulously researched account of how the Murdoch media brutally and relentlessly targets, then takes down, people it doesn't like, across three continents. In doing so, it demonstrates how the apparent screeches for the free speech have a chilling effect on the ability for people they disagree with to speak out without punishment. Its authors are Andrew Dodd and Matthew Ricketson, both of whom have done their time in the Murdoch stable. Andrew Dodd is a professor of journalism at the University of Melbourne. His journalism career included time at the 7:30 Report and Radio National, where he founded the long-running Media Report program. And he was a Triple R newsreader in 1980.
The 1980s.
The 1980s. I have already defamed him. This is his third book. Welcome to Spin Cycle, Andrew.
Thank you so much. It is lovely to be back at Triple R. Triple R is kind of my home. I love this place and I love what you do. So it's lovely to be here. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so glad. And I love that you started here because it can also balances out some of the like right-wing media journalists that have come out of this stable. So
only
that's
a handful.
It's a broad church. I thought we were all in favour of that.
I think when I read the book, Andrew, I did say to you off air, I'm like, oh, another Murdoch book. But honestly, from the minute that I started, I think what I really appreciate about this book, A, it's eminently readable. I want listeners to know that. But B, that it takes a lot of scenarios that we've lived through, that we've watched sort of play out in the Murdoch media, and brings them together. I mean, the research is meticulous. I love the fact that we get the point of view as well of people who have been Murdoched, but also takes them back to Rupert Murdoch himself. I love the context that you give, like the through line that you give all of these stories. And even like there was one thing that really stood out for me early in the book are the anecdotes that demonstrate how hands-on Rupert Murdoch has been. And I was quite shocked when there were these stories about him sort of walking into the newsroom at the New York Post and literally changing the copy or completely and leaving someone's byline on it, which just to me is like psychopathic.
Yeah, this is a case at the New York Post when there'd been an incident in Washington, D.C., which was more than an incident. It was a hostage situation involving a couple of people who you'd have to describe as terrorists, really. And Rupert thought, well, this is a good story. Let's amplify this and in the process demonize Muslims. And he came in at, I think it was 3 a.m. and rewrote the copy, and people talk about this story now. They can still vividly remember when he did it, and led with a lurid headline which covered the entire front page of the New York Post about let's behead them or something. And it was a deeply sensational anti-Islamic story which says a lot about Rupert's allegiances to Israel, which have been lifelong and sincere on his part. And that in turn says quite a bit about the coverage that we're seeing now in Murdoch papers around the world about Palestine and Gaza.
I wanted to ask there about, you know, you make this case that he was very, very hands-on in the early days, but in the more recent decades, it's not that he's hands-on, it's just that the Murdoch media's enemies are his enemies, and everybody in his newsroom
has like imbibed that sense of the world.
Understands what this, who they're supposed to go after, and who the enemy is.
How has he seeded that culture?
How did he manage that with a global empire?
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, you have to stand back and say, "Wow, what has this guy accomplished?" And in a global business sense, it is absolutely extraordinary. He is by far the most powerful global media owner. I suppose you could argue now that Elon Musk has sort of got a global reach in ways that Rupert hasn't, but nevertheless, it's quite clear that he is. And from the get-go, he was setting his ethos on the company, and he says of it, it's a company founded in my image. And the way you entrench that culture is that you, early on in the ownership of something, go in at 3 a.m. and let everybody know that you're writing the copy and it has this line on it. He doesn't need to do that again, or not many times, because people just know they imbibe this culture. And he appoints the right editors who appoint the right staff. Every now and again they make a mistake and appoint someone like me, but, you know, let's
not. We'll return to that, I'm sure.
But you create a culture like that. You don't need to be hands-on or on the phone every day telling people what to do.
Can we take a step back and actually kind of define, I guess, because the lens through which this looks at Murdoch is obviously the individual subjects of these kinds of campaigns. Could we get into a bit about like the difference between being Murdoched in the sense that you guys are writing about and just like legitimate scrutiny of a public figure?
Yeah, absolutely. And we talk about the thin line sometimes that gets crossed between good journalism and bullying. Good journalism requires a lot of perseverance. We're all told as journalists, you have to be dogged. You've got to chase a story. You've got to be committed to it. Bullying is when there's too much perseverance and when you don't know when to stop. And when you've stopped telling a story that seeks to tell all sides and you've begun to be a partisan player. And you're accentuating one side of the story at the expense of the other, and you don't care about the implications that it has on the people you're writing about. And we see that in all of the cases. In fact, the line isn't thin in many of the cases we talk about. It's a gulf, and News Corp has crossed the gulf. so brazenly that we don't have to argue about whether or not this is good journalism. It's become lousy journalism and outright bullying.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about your history with News Corp here, if we can, because you mentioned in the introduction that you worked there and you were put on a story that, well, it wasn't, I don't think it would be quite the extent of getting Murdoch'd that many of the victims in this book have faced, but you were asked to go on the attack on someone who didn't necessarily deserve it.
Yeah, exactly. It was a quiet,
and you did it.
Yeah, it was a quiet news day at The Australian. I got a phone call and I was told that somebody in news conference didn't like Daryl Summers very much and that I should look into it. And this meant that I had to put aside whatever I was doing that day and focus on trying to find a story about Daryl Summers. And I use this example in the book to illustrate how, as a reporter, you get dragged down these rabbit holes sometimes, and sometimes you make the mistake of getting a bit too enthusiastic about a job that the editor wants done. And on this occasion, I did. I actually pursued the story and started to get invested in this narrative that Daryl Summers was too controlling and that people didn't like working with him anymore. And it ran as a front page story on the day that he had his last program on air. Aww. After being on air for 28 years.
Oh, no.
This really ungracious bit of reporting that just sort of ripped him apart, including a photo on the front page of him being papped, coming out of the Channel 9 studios looking kind of surprised and startled. And the whole thing was just unnecessary. It had an ungracious tone to it. And I honestly felt sick when I read it. I thought, what have I done? What have I been a party to? And I use this as an example of to illustrate how easy it is to swallow the Kool-Aid.
I was going to ask about that because I think the one thing this book does really well is it sort of there are loads. I love the detail you go into in Australia, but also then we also look at the UK and obviously Fox News in America, which is its own kind of weird beast. How it's almost like a brand, a template. Like how can and we also you talk about journalists. Like there's an amazing chapter about where you talk about Larissa Behrendt and Anita Hess, who was so generous in their interviews with you as well. And it's so great to hear this perspective of people who have been Murdoch'd. And, you know, Patricia Cavellis in this case was writing for Murdoch and was probably the journalist who really doggedly pursued them in that situation and then moves to the ABC. So she's a, you know, prominent ABC journalist now. And you just think, how can you so easily shift from one very specific type of journalism to another? Or what is it that when people go to Murdoch that they can click into this type of journalism that arguably is not necessary? It skates the line in terms of, like you said, what is journalism and what is bullying?
Yeah, the Patricia Carvelis case is really interesting because not only did she go to the ABC, but once she got there, she got bullied too.
By Murdoch. Yeah.
And this is quite a common thing where people who've left the company get bullied. It's happened to others. Louise Milligan is a very good example of this. You know, bullied relentlessly for her pursuit of Cardinal Pell.
Yeah.
And you know, in terms of why people can be one thing within one organisation and then another within another, it's really, I think, human nature. It's a bit of the pack mentality where we want to fit in wherever we are and we want to be loyal to the company that employs us, and that's almost enough. And you begin to lose sight, I think, when you're within it, of what the higher calling is here and that sort of pursuit of journalism at its very best. And the other thing about the craft or the business is that there isn't a lot of time in it for reflection. You're always on these daily deadlines, which are themselves relentless. So you don't get time to sit down and think, now, what did I do today? How could I have done it better? Was I true to myself in what I did today? And so the train just goes on.
Well, if you're being rewarded for something that is completely not necessarily true to yourself, and also if you're looking at who is being rewarded within the company, then, you know, I guess like any organisation like that, the people who can't stomach it will leave eventually and the ones who are really good at it go far.
Have you had much feedback from people within News Corp?
No. So we were thinking about this. Of course, at some point they'll respond or they won't. And if they respond, they'll, of course, come for us with, you know, all guns blazing, or they'll ignore us. So they're basically the two strands or approaches. I suspect at some point they'll come for us, but they haven't yet.
I want to ask about a couple of specific... I mean, we should sort of set the scene. You spoke to so many people to write this book. The two of you spoke with... What, you went through over 50...
There are 50 case studies and we must have spoken to 60 or 70 people.
Amazing. One that stood out for me, and I lived in the UK for 10 years and I think I was there when some of this was going on. I obviously didn't buy tabloid papers, but it's all around you, so I sort of saw it. The fake chic.
Oh, yeah.
God. Can you talk through that? Because that is despicable.
Yeah, look, I agree. And Matthew and I, Matthew Ricketson, my co-author, we're often asked which are the worst examples. Matthew talks about the case of Millie Dowler, the schoolgirl whose phone was hacked. Mm. I go to Mazza Mahmood, the fake sheikh. For me, what he did was so appalling. It's just so reprehensible. He lured people into traps where he would force them into situations where they were encouraged to act in a criminal way, and of course it was all on hidden camera, and then they would be exposed. So somebody who wants to break into the film industry are lured to some remote resort under the promise of being involved in a film deal that will involve a famous actor like Leonardo DiCaprio. And they'll become famous. So, of course, the struggling actor, accepts it. And then they'll be encouraged to transport cocaine from one hotel room to another because the producer of the film is interested in cocaine. So they'll do that because they want to please the person who's lured them. It's all filmed. 3 days later, they're on the front page of News of the World. Their career is over. Mm-hmm. Not only that, their life is wrecked. And Mazza Mahmood
resulted in... His work resulted in how many... actual sort of prison sentences and court cases, really, police convictions.
Yeah, so the number that he purports happened as a result of that was something like 200. I don't have the figures in front of me, but the actual figure is much less. And he only was made to be accountable for this at the Leveson inquiry when he's dragged before Justice Leveson, and Paddy French, a journalist in the UK, had done some work. The poor guy had gone into the British Library and pulled out every edition of the News of the World while Mazza Mahmood had been on staff. I don't know how he did it, and read every single one of them and traced all of the stories that Mazza Mahmood had done and what had happened to all of the people that he'd written about and discovered that the numbers of convictions that Mazza Mahmood was bragging about was way higher in his mind than the actual figure. And it just pointed to the brazen lies of the guy and the fact that he got off on telling people that people had got arrested.
I was going to say, I suppose we've touched on this a little bit already, but like, what do you kind of identify as the psychology behind that? Because that can't be... Because no one
can presume... It's not about going after progressives or...
There's no ideology, obviously, at play there. And there's no obvious higher calling that someone is saying, well, I'm doing a good job by creating crimes to then report on.
Well, the crazy thing is that he thought that he was acting in the public interest.
Yeah, he thought he was being morally... He thought that if these people were going to make these moral... transgressions, then they were, and they were also public figures, even if they were just two-bit celebrities.
Yeah, so the idea here is they're hypocrites. You know, they're out there in the public domain saying one thing, but on the other they've got a minor drug habit, or, you know, they're not quite as pure as they might be made out to be on the soap opera that they're on or whatever. And he was asked about this at Leveson and he said, yeah, celebrities have to be accountable. And this idea that a celebrity is just fair game and has no right to any privacy is something that you see, it's redolent in the tabloid culture. And, of course, this is something that Murdoch has encouraged. He's been a lifelong devotee of gossip. He loves it. He can't get enough of it. And gossip is one of the ways in which he makes his publications more popular. It's exactly what he did in the New York Post. He introduced a thing called the Page Six column, which was a way of transforming the New York Post for that Manhattan audience. And he cannot get enough of this kind of scurrilous rubbish.
For me, the most outrageous stuff, and I think, you know, you've got a lot of Australian examples, a lot of the public intellectuals and journalists and progressives that you have examples of are in Australia, and it's just the way that anybody who goes against the Murdoch ideology gets absolutely, like, in some cases destroyed, driven out of the country. But it's the way that this company, but this individual has sort of shaped our entire discourse and inspired fear in anybody who wants to speak out on Anzac Day or war crimes.
Yeah. So the fact that they've backed Ben Robert Smith, and this was a case in parallel with one in the US, the case of Eddie Gallagher, who is the United States Ben Robert Smith. And Fox News, namely through Pete Hegseth, when he was a presenter on Fox News, was his champion and managed to get Donald Trump to exonerate him. In fairness to this particular person, he had been found by a military tribunal to be only guilty of one of the seven charges. But even that is all kind of weird because in that trial, somebody turned and changed their evidence and so on. But in any case, here is Pete Hegseth being a champion for somebody who has been accused of the most appalling war crimes, and he knows that Trump is listening because, of course, Trump is a keen listener of Fox News, a former presenter himself on Fox News, and Hegseth knows that when he's talking, he is talking directly to the president, as do many other people who want to change things. So this is why Fox News is so important in the media ecosystem in the US. It's because it is this main
Trump
line
is
through
glued
to Trump.
To it. Yep. Do you think, I mean, we were talking about this off air before, before the show, we were talking about like the what influence does it have in Australia at the moment? What has their influence waned? And you know, we know that obviously the political class here definitely reads The Australian and watches Sky News in the airport sort of lounges. Is it the same as in the States, or are they completely different? Does Murdoch change? Does it differ in the way that approaches those sort of that sort of attack journalism in these different countries? Because it doesn't feel as direct line here, but it still feels influential on the political class a little bit.
Well, I think a way of thinking about it is to sort of classify Sky News and Sky After Dark as Fox Light or a Fox wannabe. Many of the same sort of attack lines, the same sort of editorial positions are similar. I saw this when I was literally in the US and saw them attacking Dylan Mulvaney, the trans influencer, came back to Australia 2 months later, and it was like they had the same scripts. And, 2 months later they were parroting the same stuff. It's like they must have had a quiet news day at Sky After Dark and thought, God, what'll we do? Here's a script from Fox. And there was Rita Panahi saying exactly the same things that the presenters on Fox News have been saying about somebody who'd been promoting a beer which is really not even on sale in Australia.
Yeah. I've never seen a Bud Light in a thing. What possible influence could this have on my day? I suppose actually that does come to a question I've been wanting to ask about. Like, for the longest time, even critics of News Corp would say, but you have to at least take into account some of the great journalism that they do and the fact that in some cases it is genuinely unpartisan and it's genuinely effective and it has. Do you think that's still the case in Australia? And if not, kind of when did that kind of sense of preoccupation, that sense of, preoccupation with certain right-wing talking points and individuals on the left, when do you think that balance shifted, if indeed you do think it has?
Yeah, it's a great question, and we're often asked that too. And I'm so glad you asked it because it is important to acknowledge that, of course, some good journalism comes out of News Corp. It's really important to say that.
Yeah.
But it's also important, I think, to think about when it did change in the way you've described, because it did. When I accepted a position at The Australian in the late 1990s, it was a paper that I was, kind of proud to work for. Yeah. It was a paper that allowed you to do things critically. They were starting a media section. They wanted to be as critical of the media in general as The Guardian's media section. They thought this might be a way of bringing in advertisers and creating a community of interest. It didn't quite work out that way, but the paper was a good one to work for. And at the time, we used to describe it as being the best and worst of Australian journalism because it had some really good stuff in it and some terrible stuff. That changed with a new editor, Chris Mitchell, when he came in about 2003 or 4. Things changed dramatically. It became sort of tabloid-esque in the way it pursued stuff, so that you turn over every page and you could point to articles and say, that's got an agenda, that one's got an agenda, that article, well, I know where that's coming from because that follows the line of And the paper just lost all credibility. And that was the point that I seriously started looking for another job.
It is incredible to read, say, old Greg Sheridan, for example, about Pauline Hanson and about refugees. And it's unrecognisable to the same writer in the same paper 25 years later.
Yeah.
I am wondering, though, you know, it's lost its credibility, but it feels like in the last few years it's lost its bite. Like it has, even since the book has been published, I'm sure it was frustrating watching them go after people in the last few months when it was already out to print, but like going after people like Rhonda Abdel-Fattah and not quite succeeding. And I would even argue in the last few days trying to get Anthony Albanese on this Kylie Minogue stuff, and that one is probably quite a beat up, but they don't seem to be able to
generate that sense of crisis that they used to be able to.
Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation. I think it's changed. You know, a way of thinking about that is something that Neil Kinnock said to us when we were researching the book. He said, it's not the two or three headlines that happened during the election campaign that lost him the election. It's the chipping away over 3 or 4 years that does the damage. And this is kind of what News Corp still does across its stable in Australia and everywhere. So that chipping that we've seen post-budget, for example, that's going to continue right through to election day. And, of course, there is some legitimacy to that. There is some public interest in talking about a broken promise. But the trouble is you begin to doubt the bona fides of what's going on in the journalism because it's just so partisan and it's just so deliberate in its mission to denigrate the government and to elevate the opposition.
Yeah, do you think that is actually going to actually hurt the government in the way that that Murdoch could in previous years, like, bring down a Labor government?
Well, they've been trying for years to get rid of the Victorian Labor government. They tried desperately with Dan Andrews and it backfired, and he won more seats than he had the previous election.
So, my sneaky little theory is that the Victorian Labor government's going to hold on somehow.
I share that. I think somehow they're going to as well. It can't help is part of the answer. So the coverage does not help the chances of people they're attacking. And where I think it is influential is it affects the editorial positions of other outlets, including the ABC. The ABC is far too beholden to the News Corp agenda, and it has made attempts to break free, and under the current chairman, Kim Williams, has sort of definitely tried to do that, but it hasn't done it successfully enough yet. And the point that Malcolm Turnbull made at the launch of this book last week was he said, we've all got to realise that this guy is living rent-free in our heads and we've got to evict him. And that advice would be useful for the ABC and other media outlets.
If you have just tuned in, we are talking to Andrew Dodd, who is alongside Matthew Ricketson, the author of Getting Murdoch'd, How Murdoch's Media Wields Power and Punishment. Just going to a couple of texts that we have received, and I know a lot of us are very, you know, one of the biggest stories of being Murdoch'd is Yasmin Abdul-Majeed. And, someone's texted in about that. In fact, a couple of people have texted in about that. And one thing that I found very interesting reading your book is, a couple of the stories that are really relevant to me, like Roz Ward with Safe Schools and Yasmin, because this happened in our lifetime and lived through it. I interviewed Roz here after that. And obviously some people were going to talk to you and some just don't want to revisit it again. Both Roz and Yasmin didn't talk to you. Let's talk about Yasmin's story, because that is a really interesting story about, you know, it's about the Anzac myth, and that's when an organisation that crows about free speech, but you have to only speak about this mythology in a very certain way, and or you will get hounded out of the country. Can you talk to us about her situation, and then, you know, not speaking to her? Did that affect the way that you included that story in the book?
Yeah, we really wanted to include the story of Yasmin, and her story is a really important one. So here is a vivacious, entirely intelligent public intellectual who happens to be a Muslim and happens to be a woman. and happened to send out a tweet that questioned some of the mythology about Anzac Day and then got attacked. And she didn't just get attacked once. She didn't get the drive-by sort of Murdoching. She got the full symphony.
Mm.
And so much so that it led to her leaving the country. So we did approach her, and we approached her through an intermediary and a friend of hers, and we tried to be mindful about the way we did it because, of course, the book is all about traumatizing, the effect of traumatizing people, and we didn't want to be a party to re-traumatizing. So in that case, we heard through this person that she didn't want to talk about it, but she was okay with us telling the story. And we sent to her the version of the story as it appeared before it was published. And we tried to do this where people didn't talk to us. And in the case of the Safe Schools program, we did that through the prism of Benjamin Law writing about it and how he in turn was attacked again relentlessly by The Australian because he had written about it. But it was also useful because it illustrated another modus operandi of Murdoching, which is where somebody makes a mistake. And in Benjamin Law's case, he made a mistake. He sent a tweet that was ill-advised at just the wrong moment, just after his quarterly essay comes out, which said some really important things about the way in which the Safe Schools program had been denigrated by the Murdoch press.
It was such a good quarterly essay in terms of the data analysis of it, like the column inches that were dedicated to this tiny program. It was very good. It was a really good essay.
Yeah, it was. And so he made the mistake of sending out a tweet, which really was terribly badly advised, right? It was a
brain fart.
Yeah, it really was. And he regretted it instantly. And, of course, everybody jumped on him.
Mm.
Well, by that, I mean News Corp jumped on him. So much so that every interview he did about the quarterly essay afterwards was him having to defend this tweet.
Mm.
And that approach of making a mistake in the thick of battle is something that comes back again and again. Larissa Berendt.
I would love to talk about that, but it's so interesting, instructive, because when I even promoted this interview on Blue Sky, someone left a comment of their own experience of getting Murdoched in a really similar situation. They made a tweet which was willfully taken out of context, and this was someone who is not in a position of power. They're not a Benjamin Law, even. They've got no platform. They are an activist for robo-debt, you know, as someone who has experience of that system, the Centrelink system, and they got Murdoched. They got their own experience of being Murdoched. So can you talk to us about that, sucking a tweet or a comment out of social media? Like, how has social media powered this getting Murdoched experience and almost like taken that, given them even more, like turbocharged this ability? You said this, even though it might get completely taken out of context.
Well, it is taken out of context. Although in the case of Larissa Berendt, again, she said something that she shouldn't have. It was during the thick of the debate and on Q&A, they were talking about the intervention in the Northern Territory. She flicked over to another channel, watched another program where somebody was having sex with a horse. And she conflated these two ideas in one tweet, right? She'll be the first.
Ill-advised.
She'll be the first to admit it wasn't a great idea.
Well, she literally like sent an
tweeting
apology.
Is never a great idea.
She apologized publicly. She sent an apology to Best Price, the subject of the joke.
Well, she deleted it very quickly as well. Like, she acknowledged the.
The same for Yasmin. Mm. I didn't quite realize that until I was
deleted
her post so quickly.
We talk about the irony deficiency at News Corp, right? They know it's irony. They know it's humour. And they choose to use the words literally because it's a way of hitting somebody back. And in all of those cases, that's exactly what happened. They didn't choose to see the inner meaning. They didn't choose to see the context or the nuance or the humour. They just used it as a platform for attacking. And even when Larissa Berendt apologised fulsomely to Bess Price a day or two later, that apology was weaponized against her so she could do nothing right.
Yeah.
The attacks went for 16 days. She was subject of 6 to 16 articles. The effect they had on Larissa were powerful and damaging.
I'm so glad that Larissa and Anita spoke to you, because it's so important to hear that firsthand perspective of what it's like to live in that. The way, and Larissa was so open with you, which was amazing. And I'd like to hear your perspective on that interview process. But the way she talks about the just her deepest, darkest moments of just not even knowing who she could talk to, who she could even face in her life.
Yeah, so 2 points. You're absolutely right. These first-hand accounts is something that we wanted to promote in the book. We wanted to allow people to see the effect by getting to know the people who were bullied. And we do this particularly with a guy called Kazir Khan in the US, the most dignified man you'll ever meet, and how he was bullied by Fox News is just disgusting. But by meeting these people and hearing their stories, there is some rapport that's developed with them. And the other point is that the effect that it has on them is long-lasting and extremely damaging. And so for all of the people who spoke to us, Matthew and I are just so grateful because they were so courageous, because many of them knew that by saying what they said, they opened up the possibility of the people at News Corp getting in the truck and reversing over them again. And, you know, I think of Clive Hamilton. He told us the very thing that they said about him that most affected him. So now he is given to News Corp the ammunition that they could use against him if they wish to. And we're so grateful to him, because what we wanted to get from these people is how they were most affected. And that often means they were got at in a certain way because they said something that really affected their core and affected their own self-image. With Margaret Simons, they questioned her journalism. That affected her deeply. With Jenna Price, they affected her. They criticised her teaching. And anyone who knows Jenna Price at UTS, she's the most dedicated teacher you'll ever meet. So in each case, they find the soft point and they attack them through it, and it's very damaging.
Yeah. I mean, the case...
Sarah Schwartz as well, sorry.
What I was going to say, these cases... We're all, like, familiar with them, but I think you've brought a new layer of understanding, like, once the press pack moves on, and the pack, I mean the Murdoch pack, but what consequences are left in people's lives. And it's really, I mean, it's scary and it's kind of off-putting. I'm sort of glad we're past the age of putting stupid shit on Twitter, but it is scary as progressives, you know, as people who host a show on Triple R about the media, you know, it is like
it onto Sky News Media Show once.
Congratulations.
I think it was before my time. Yeah, I think it might have been before my time.
Yeah, it was Najma and I.
Yeah, I've been referred to as like a left-wing journalist or something, activist journalist or whatever. But it's scary. And laying out what actually happens here is scary. What do we do about it? What is the proposed solution for Murdoch?
In the last 5 minutes.
Yes, we have 5 minutes to tell us.
There's the big picture and the small picture. The small picture we address at the end. We list a few ways in which people who are being attacked can respond. And this was drawn from all of those interviews where we asked people, what would you advise others do in the situation that you go through? And one of the points that sticks out to me is the very last one, and it's really particularly important in Larissa Berendt's case, because she was the subject of a really beautiful letter from Robert Mann, who himself had been abused, and the letter from Robert Mann reassured her that she'll be okay, she'll get through it, and reminded her that she must have said something pretty important for this to be happening, and don't doubt yourself. And then in turn Larissa sent a letter to Benjamin Law and so there was this, we call it a daisy chain of sort of support, and so when you see someone being Murdoch'd, reach out to them, let them know that it's okay, it'll be all right, let them know they'll get through it. That's the small picture. The big picture is, how do you reform the media? There isn't enough time.
There's 3 minutes and 45 seconds.
Just quickly on that, though, I did want to ask one quick question before we go. The way people responded was quite interesting, very different ways of responding. Some people obviously left the country. Some went to ground. Some shut down. There was, I can't remember her name, responded by literally taking a week off work and analysing every single piece and going through it and pulling out all the mistakes and
Michelle
all
Telfer.
The errors. Michelle Telfer.
An extraordinary person.
Yes. So what do you think about having looked at all these different ways of responding, is there one that you would advise based on, because I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
Michelle's response was amazing. And yeah. you said when you wrote in the book, you said it went to the jugular of Murdoch's weakness, which is they don't have time to do the research properly.
Yeah. Another way people do it is they harness social media because they're often more savvy than the people that are writing about them. Mm. So they let the world know about the individual who wrote about them rather than the amorphous company. Mm. There are loads of responses. One is the Malcolm Turnbull approach, which is to play whack-a-mole. Wherever they say anything, you whack it immediately. The other is that you go to ground for a little while and rest and recuperate and then come back strong, as we talk about in the case of Flint, a trans teacher in the
that's
US.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that story was incredible.
So loads of different approaches, and they'll suit different personalities. But the point is to remember that you can wrest back control of the debate over time. You don't have to do it in the moment.
Hmm. We've been talking to Andrew Dodd, one of the authors with Matthew Ricketson of Getting Murdoch'd, an incredible book. It is truly wonderful. It should be on every school curriculum.
That'll be on Sky.
You've been listening to Spin Cycle on Triple R. Stick around for Neil Rogers and the Australian Mood. You must come to our live show in
yes,
the Triple R.
You 1 must. Week from now. Text us and we with your name. We'll put you on the door.
We've got some names here. Please, you have to come. We will see you then. Bye for now. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.